people to hear that.
Most of the destruction made way for parking lots. In one of his lectures, Olin Dotson of Ball State University displays a photo of a house with a white picket fence in the middle of a parking lot. The lady who owned it was the lone holdout.
Wow. So while she's sitting on her stoop or like sweeping her porch, students are literally parked all around her.
Yeah. It's really sad, actually. And when I walked down Indiana Avenue, I saw no evidence of the thriving, vibrant neighborhood of Black homes, businesses, and clubs that once was.
Right. The only remnant of that Black history is the Madam Walker Legacy Center.
While the Madam Walker building in the 600 block is a National Historic Landmark, everything else in that block was torn down. And so to recreate the fabric of that community and to honor those ancestors is what I think is very important to tell.
The stories of a crew of folks working to reclaim not just Indiana Avenue, but the histories of Black neighborhoods throughout Indianapolis in part two.
You were just listening to Urbanist Media and their podcast, Urban Roots, and that does it for today's show. If you'd like more information, please visit us online at focmedia.org. I'm Salima Hamarani. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
I'm Molly, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Do you need some quiet mood music? Some soothing sounds?
Well, then never listen to Life During Wartime, because they just play really obnoxious DIY punk from local bands and international acts. Sometimes they have bands play live, and it's all with the yelling and the screaming and the, I don't like my mom and dad or my teachers and all that kind of stuff. That's Life During Wartime, every other Wednesday from 10 to midnight, here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Andy Warhol looks a scream, and him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver stream, can't tell them apart at all.
My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is artist Christopher Marley, whose show Exquisite Creatures Revealed is on now at the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry through February 17th. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus by Zoom, Christopher.
I'm happy to do it. Generally, when I start the exhibit, I want people to kind of be captivated by something that's beautiful, something that is kind of universally appreciable. That usually ends up being butterflies because they're kind of the most innocuous and universally adored organisms I work with. And so in this iteration, actually, the opening piece is a rather large piece that I made for my wife. And she suffered from the cobbler's wife syndrome, having no shoes for probably 20 some years before I finally made a piece for her. And so she was very protective of it. And when I said, we're doing, you know, this exhibit locally, she said, well, okay, I'm going to loan my piece, but it's not for sale for any amount of money. And she was very protective. So that piece is just a lot of really beautiful iridescent butterflies, mostly Morphos and Lycinidae, which are two different, one's a tribe, one's a family, butterflies from really all over the world, and mostly in blues and purples.
That particular kind of turquoisey, iridescent blue, does it have its own name in the Pantone scale?
Well, yeah, not really, because it shifts. So they're called morphos for that very reason, because their colors morph depending on the angle that you're viewing them from and depending on where the light's hitting them. And so that's a phenomenon called constructive interference, where there are multiple layers that you're viewing at the same time of these structures. Their scales, if you took a cross section of a morpho scale, it looks kind of like a Christmas tree. And so there's all these different layers, all these different levels where the light can hit and can refract. And so you're going to see really slightly different shades of blue and purple, depending on where you're looking at it from. Mm-hmm.
Another one of the pieces that really stands out when you come in is these massive arrays of Beatles. Again, you can go for the very iridescent Beatles, the blues and the greens, and we're all kind of familiar with them because I think you see that kind of color even in black Beatles, you know, sort of, or even, you know, in the US, say, or Europe. But then you find these incredible other spotted ones, and there's one that looks like it's made of solid gold.
Yeah.
And so you take all these Beatles of different sizes and arrange them in, I don't know what your organizational method is.
I call them mosaics, basically. It's basically, I'm just trying to kind of create a nice even flow of negative space and kind of clean them up and tuck on their legs so that there's not a lot of any visual distraction, and you're able to just really focus on the color and texture is really all I'm about with the big Beatle mosaics. It's really perhaps the best manifestation of the wonder of biodiversity is in beetles. I mean, you know, if you lined up one of every plant and animal on the planet, every seventh one would be a beetle, and every what? Fifth would be a weevil, believe it or not. So there really? Are just there are just endless variety of beetles throughout the world. And so, of course, most of them are fairly unremarkable, and it takes some digging and searching and traveling to be able to find the most beautiful and iridescent beetles. And some of them really make no sense, kind of like the one that you described, the solid gold, or there's some that are just like chrome. These are jewel scarabs, and jewel scarabs are mostly Central and South American. And there's really a jewel scarab to match almost every sheen of metal that we have as humans. It's just amazing to think about what on earth are they trying to do out in the middle of the jungle, trying to represent chrome or burnished, you know, aluminum or bronze or gold. It's just amazing, and it's so fun to share that with
you. Have you ever come across a scientist who's tried to give an evolutionary?
There are some people have taken a stab at it. Some people opine that perhaps they're meant to represent, you know, these come from tropical rainforests, and so perhaps they're meant to represent dewdrops or, you know, a reflection of a wet leaf or something. But no one really knows. We are part of the natural world. Humanity is. But I think we're a little bit special in the natural world. And I like to think that there's just elements of nature that we're meant to enjoy. It's kind of an indication that we as human beings are meant for something more than mere survival. That there is something that nature feeds us in so many ways, emotionally and spiritually, that really have no discernible evolutionary purpose other than enjoyment.
Mm-hmm. So the context of this show is, you know, OMSI, a science museum, lots of kids running around, touching everything.
Yep.
Yeah, I like how you put things low, everything's behind glass. You know, it feels like the objects are safe. What other contexts do you show in? Do you show in like art galleries or...
Yeah, actually, I just came before OMSI. We barely made it out of Crystal Bridges in Arkansas. It's the Walton family created a world class art museum in Bentonville, Arkansas, and so we were there just before we opened at OMSI, and did very, very well there. I think we actually broke their all time attendance records for any exhibit they've ever done. So we were really, really pleased with that. So yeah, it's really the full name of the exhibit is Exquisite Creatures, A Dialogue with Art, Nature, and Science. And so it really is meant to be kind of an expose of that rarefied world where those three elements of the human experience intersect.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really equally at home in a science museum, in a natural history museum, or in an art museum.
Well, what's your discussion with Crystal Springs when they... Do you just talk in aesthetic terms with them and science
yeah,
terms
actually.
With another kind of exhibitor?
Yeah, a little bit. I'm kind of a hack in all three. So, yeah.
If they ask you to give a talk, they want art.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But, you know, it's really interesting. It's not a radical concept to mix the worlds of art and nature. Not at all. You know, when you look back into the history of all of the art that has really lasted, the vast majority of it has been nature-based, nature-related, nature-inspired. In fact, to some degree, it really kind of feels like the separation that we have imposed on human creativity and the natural world is more foreign than historically. You know, art and nature have been historically really well, really, really interrelated.
Well, I mean, I guess nature art has been kind of shoved aside since the Second World War. You know, it's not serious enough.
That's right.
So it does kind of come and go. What do people say to you about the idea of using actual objects and creatures to create art instead of you're not just painting these things?
All of the organisms are real, natural. All the colors are true to life. In the vast majority of cases, I don't do anything whatsoever to preserve the colors. A lot of the, especially the beetles, butterflies, a lot of the iridescence is really very structural coloration is usually quite stable. And I do have to do some restoration of color in some of the reptiles and most of the fish. For the most part, most of the organisms are completely, you know, they're taken and they're cleaned up and they're presented. Mm-hmm. As far as the response goes, is overwhelmingly positive. There is just a lot of people who get really, really moved and really touched to be able to have such an intimate interaction with such arcane, bizarre, you know, previously unknown organisms. And it's something that I never gets old to me. That's really the best part of my work is being able to see that kind of those faces light up and see people make connections where perhaps they had never, ever made a connection, at least to that type of organism before.
Another piece is a bunch of chameleons, and they're all kind of lined up like usual suspects almost. It's like a lineup, but there's several rows of them.
Right.
The colors are amazing. You've got these pink and blues and claret and blues and green and yellows. And they honestly, they look like plastic. They look like the rubber toys you get in the museum store.
Yeah.
The definition was so fine. The color was so consistent. The shape, you know. So one, why are they standing up? Why are they in natural poses, not just flopped down? And two, why does the color remain after life?
That's one example where there does have to be some color restoration on chameleons. I've had a few. So everything that I have some really beautiful transparent alcohol-based inks and dyes that are very transparent. They don't. So, I mean, what you see in the exhibit, anytime I've restored any color, it's not quite up to the vibrancy that you'd see in the wild, to be honest with you. But I get as close as I can. So one of the things that I've really tried to do is to really separate the organism from kind of what we identify with as the life history or the mannerisms of the organism. When we think about, you know, a shark, we think of, you know, what does a shark do? Oh, a shark, you know, eats things and it bites people and it, or what does a snake do? Well, snakes, you know, constrict and they coil. And I really wanted to, from the very beginning, take organisms, particularly organisms that are maybe a little less loved, and get people to see them with fresh eyes. And so I do a lot of juxtaposing of, you know, geometry and architecture and just kind of graphic design with wild organic nature. And there's a few departures. And the one you've mentioned, that piece is called Camille Bob, which is really embarrassing. But it's a few departures where, you know, symmetry is just not what I want to focus on with a chameleon. For chameleons, the remarkable aspect of a chameleon is just that no two are alike, that they express themselves so vibrantly through color. It's all about their emotions. And so I just wanted to show that off and wanted to have them have their personalities really be more manifest in that piece. But that's kind of a departure. I really like to do things that are static, that are geometric, that are really clean and antiseptic and architectural, so that the focus is taken off of kind of what this organism does and the focus is placed on the design elements of the organism. You know, their color and their texture and their structure and get people to kind of see them with a fresh perspective in that way.
So you do have a king cobra, I think, which is jet black, and it's huge, like 5 feet. The frame is huge and the snake is huge. But you also have other little snakes, like little yellow and white snakes. I don't know if they're babies or not, but you arrange them geometrically, you know, like kaleidoscope patterns or just crosses and asterisk kind of shapes. Is that what you're talking about? You want to arrange them when there are lots of small ones, you like to make a pattern.
Yes, I do. You'll see in the exhibit there that I've tried to create certain stories for each area. And although, you know, I tend to be really monochromatic and I'm either using black mats or white mats and all the framings are almost identical. And I really try to eliminate as many variables as I can so that it is just a clean presentation of nature in the way that I've presented it. But one of the things that I've tried to do is tell different stories throughout the exhibit. So that cobra that you mentioned, that huge, it's a 13 or 14 foot king cobra. That's in a section that's just called size. And it's just really about oversized organisms and what, and then I write about how does that affect us emotionally? How does that affect the way we interact with nature when something is just radically, you know, escaping its kind of presupposed proportions? You know, how does that affect us? And I like to be able to, again, kind of isolate these variables because, you know, nature and biodiversity is so vast, it's overwhelming, and it's honestly, it's messy, and it's for a lot of people, they don't connect with nature, I think, for that very reason, because they're like, you know, it's, I want to go outside and get dirty, and there's just too much, and it's overwhelming, and I don't know what I'm looking at. Mm-hmm. So for me, I like to kind of tell these stories that are more concise, have a bunch of examples of that story. So in that size section, there's a pelican with a 13 foot wingspan. There's two giant Japanese spider crabs. The largest has a 10 foot leg span. I mean, it's crazy. Everything's oversized in that section. Mm-hmm. You had another section on morphology where I'm talking about crazy shapes within the natural world. And everything in the morphology section is really selected because it manifests some kind of a bizarre shape that we just are not used to seeing.
Mm-hmm. You've got that. Seahorse with the incredible series of fins that look like flags or leaves or seaweed. You know,
yeah, leafy sea dragon. They're so remarkable. So yeah, it's really fun to be able to. That's actually, morphology is one of my favorite sections because I love to be able to share things with people where their first reaction is not, oh, that's bigger than I expected, or that's more color than I expected, or how did you preserve that? But their first reaction is, what am I looking at? I have no idea what this even is. That's really fun for me.
My name is Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is artist Christopher Marley. His show, Exquisite Creatures Revealed, is on now at OMSI through February 17th. Christopher, just going back to that bird, that was a pelican. I assumed it was an albatross. So you showed it off in the most wonderful way. There's like three frames, and from feet to beak is vertical, and then the wingspan are in two separate frames, and they're big, wide, you know, white wings. And of course, you got to stand in front of it with your arms out and take a photo. It's like that Michael Jordan picture of him where he's got his arms out, like this incredible wingspan.
You know, it's really funny you say that, Joseph, because last night, I actually wasn't even invited, but last night they had the Portland Trailblazers come to the exhibit. Had a private event, and they set up a photo op in front of that piece so that people could spread their you know, these giant NBA players spread their wings and see if they could match up. And I'm sure none of them did, by the way.
Well, I mean, it's funny that you cut that bird in pieces, mm-hmm. and there's a shark, another one, you know, where you cut the shark into slices, like four slices or something, but you put polished stone, you know, or jewels or something in the slices.
It's that piece is actually a fairly rare blue onyx that comes from Argentina, and you know, and it, the same with the giant pelican. A lot of times the art that I'm creating I've got practical problems. For example, when I've got a pelican with a 11 or 12 or 13 foot wingspan, and you know, the bird is huge from, you know, from beak to foot, it's another five or five and a half feet. So you can't get plexiglass that's 13 feet long and you know, 8 feet high. So I really love when I have these parameter issues, when I have some problems with practical issues that are going to make me get a little bit more creative about how I'm going to display mm-hmm. this organism. And then that goes into part of the story that I'm trying to tell as well. Mm-hmm. With the shark, that thresher shark was about 8 feet long, and it had to be freeze dried. And my freeze dryer is not that big, so I had to come up with some ways to get it freeze dried over about 6 or 8 months of a very slow process. And then with those cuts, I wanted to inlay it with something that would be backlit and just kind of talk a little bit about, you know, light within and that animating force that makes things interesting to us and makes them come alive.
Mm-hmm. All these pieces are mounted like photos or like art. They're in these deep frames with white matting, usually very, very bright light. I think the light is just the museum light coming down from above, right? Mostly.
Some of it is, some of it isn't. So I started a number of years ago to start to insert lighting inside of the frames of a number of pieces, particularly iridescent beetles. It was driving me crazy that I would go And, you know, these pieces are the specimens are just so saturated with this amazing color. And then I would put them up in, you know, in this real kind of stark museum lighting that is usually, you know, great for drama, but terrible for showing off saturation of color, and would lose so much of that color spectrum. And so I got frustrated enough that I decided that I was going to insert my own lighting inside of the frames. And so I did created this diffuse lighting system that started out with just beetle mosaics and prisms, but then it's something that I kind of started using more with some of the platforms, some of the pieces that are more three-dimensional. And then also there's a piece we were talking about before that is called Asterism, that is just a huge series of sea urchins. Mm-hmm. And that was a piece that I just wanted to have more drama. So I added that lighting internally mm-hmm. into the frame. The frame had to be about, I don't know, 10 or 11 inches deep. But that was a piece that just kind of lended itself to being able to have that more dramatic lighting.
Because the sea urchin exoskeleton, I mean, it looks like a bread roll. It's kind of a puffy round thing. But lit from behind, the light comes through the thin parts.
Exactly. So there's a couple of different pieces that I just sea urchins are my thing. They're probably my favorite organism to work with nowadays as a designer and as an artist from that mm-hmm. standpoint. Just these perfect little globs, you know, perfect little spheres that have an endless variety and endless colors and endless textures. It's just you couldn't ask for something more fun to design with. That's a very special piece where I did go through behind them and insert an LED behind each urchin, because what I found was that there's all this hidden color that you would never know even existed. That piece is really moving to me. You know, you have to remove all the spines from an urchin, and that little skeleton that's left is called a test, the urchin test. And just to know that even among urchin tests that I just love to collect, backlighting them, there's all this color within their skeleton that you'd never imagine is there. And that, to me, is really meaningful.
Christopher, you were a model in the fashion industry for 15 years. What did you learn in that industry that you applied to photography in this context as an artist?
Well, there's really two things that I got out of my stint as a model. Number one was the travel. I was able to live and work in about 35 different countries all over the world. And that really whetted my appetite for different biomes and just charging out into jungles or forests or fields or wherever country I was working in to just see what I could find. I was always a nature buff and kind of a reptile fanatic. And so I was always out looking for snakes and lizards, but it just exposed me to so many radical, crazy discoveries for me things that I never knew existed. And it just became such a passion. And then also it just kind of, I think I honed my particular aesthetic in working in high fashion. I did a lot of work for Calvin Klein and for Gucci and for Donna Karan and for Nike and for just a lot of different designers that really kind of helped me to see that my artistic expression doesn't have to be so literal. I was a graphic design major. I wanted to be an illustrator, and I would just draw and paint monsters all the time. And I would turn every you know assignment in college into another opportunity to create another monster. But seeing how fashion designers would incorporate, you know, their passion into fabrics, it kind of really opened my eyes to different ways of expressing yourself artistically.
Which part of Oregon are you from?
I grew up in the Salem area, and then was kind of all over the world for mm-hmm. about 15 years or 20 years, and then made my way back into the Salem area again.
Because I love that you say the first place you went was the Atacama Desert after Oregon. You went from the wettest place to the driest place.
That's
right. Must have just blown your mind. Like that experience must come back to you all the time.
Yeah, it really does. The first city I lived in Chile was Calama, which is generally considered the driest spot on the planet. When I was there, they hadn't rained in 400 years. So it was like living on the moon.
And then you got to explore like jungles and tribes, I presume, you know, native peoples. You just went away from the bars and the photo studios and the beaches. Oh,
I wasn't much in the modeling culture, I suppose. Yeah. I wasn't really into it, but I did. I had a great opportunities. And then when I started collecting insects was where I started. And when I started really getting just serious about getting out into jungles and forests and trying to find different species that I wasn't aware of, and eventually new species altogether. Mm-hmm. I was able to kind of retrace my steps in a lot of the places that I had visited before as a model. and then start exploring in completely new areas.
The listeners should know that this show also has plants, you know, the pitcher plants and orchids, and it also has rocks and minerals. So, you know, like you'd see at the Rice Museum, there are the fluorescent rocks and minerals, and you basically cast a very wide net and you treat things in very different ways. There's an awful lot of variety in what you're looking for, you know, like you say, size or morphology or whatever. If you were plonked down in a new country you'd never been to in the countryside now, what would you go out looking for on day one?
Generally, insects and urchins. Those are the two things that I really collect myself and I get most excited about. And as long as you're, of course, urchins, or as long as you're, it's a coastal country, they're probably the two easiest things to just start finding wherever you are. You know, I've found remarkable insect specimens, you know, on shoots in mansions in South Africa, just hanging on the wall, you know, and just had a great time doing that. And then urchins are generally pretty easy to find. Oftentimes they are, if not invasive, they're quite destructive when there's actually the Oregon coast has got real problems with an overabundance of urchins, and they're really destructive to reefs and to oceanic habitat. Mm-hmm. And so generally urchins are pretty easy to find. And the nice thing about urchins too is that there's almost no serious urchin collectors in the world. And so it's really fun and really easy to find something that you've never even seen a picture of before when you're out in a different country collecting urchins.
Do the locals tell you we have this big ant or something, or do you just go wandering around?
Well, anymore, I mean, I'm pretty well connected nowadays, and I really tend to prefer working with, you know, people, indigenous peoples in different countries that have their own little micro businesses and support them when I can. There's a lot of people who really work in conjunction with their environment in a very sustainable way, and I like to give them my business if I can. I'm not nearly as adventurous as I used to be. So there's a lot of great people that I work with in different countries that are on the lookout, that this is what they do.
Oh, so they're just texting you a picture or something. You're like, oh, okay, let me FedEx a couple of them.
Sometimes,
because in the video, there's a truck going through a muddy river, you know.
Yeah.
So you've obviously been out and done all that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
But it's possible now to get help, I guess.
It is, absolutely. Yeah. No, it would be impossible for me to do all this by myself. I've got a lot of great people I work with, and some of them are scientists and some of them are just self-taught, and some of them are, like I said, have some little family-run micro business. This is what they do. And then others are researchers, and it's one of the great things about this business has been I've been able to work with people that are deep in the sciences, deep in the arts, that are researchers, that do all kinds of things. It's just been a tremendous blessing.
When you start a piece, do you do all the handiwork yourself, or do you have assistance?
I have both. Well, both. I mean, sometimes there's pieces that I'm kind of a little bit precious about and don't want anyone else to touch. But I've got an assistant here that is wonderful, that especially does a lot of the color restoration. She's fabulous. I've got helpers all over the world.
What do you use to hold them for the paper?
If I can, I'll use mechanical fasteners because it's just safer. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times I'll inlay some wood or something that I can screw into. I've got, I don't know, 50 different kinds of adhesives depending on what it is and what the properties are.
I just think the presentation is so beautiful. The lighting is so good. You know, every frame is perfect, and the way things are arranged, like you said, the negative spaces are so well thought out.
Thank you.
It's an incredible, it's like the way people paint, but you're doing it with your objects.
Appreciate that.
Christopher, what do you want people to come away from this OMSI exhibit?
You know, a lot of people talk about the negative aspects of us kind of delving into a two-dimensional world in the last 20 years. And obviously there are, you know, there's wonderful advantages to having access to everything on our screens constantly. But there are some real serious negative repercussions. And one of those is a loss of connection to corporeal nature, to real three-dimensional nature. And my hope has always been to give people an experience that is peaceful, that is almost kind of reverent, a place where they can just be in awe and kind of rekindle those feelings of wonder and amazement at the beauty of the natural world and the extent of biodiversity. So my hope is that people will have an experience that really kindles in them or rekindles in them a love for nature and a love for their own creativity. This really is meant to be the colliding of the worlds of creativity and of the natural world. And so I hope that people go away invigorated and inspired to both love nature more and to be more creative themselves.
My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was artist Christopher Marley. His show Exquisite Creatures Revealed is on now at the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry in Portland through February 17th. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus for the first time, Christopher.
Thank you, Joseph. I enjoyed it.
Andy, whoa, whoa, looks a scream. Have him on my wall. Andy, whoa, whoa, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all.
Revois la ville en fête et en délire, suffoquant sous le soleil et sous la joie. Et j'entends dans la musique les cris, les rires qui éclatent et rebondissent autour de moi. Et perdu parmi ces gens qui me bousculent, étourdi, désemparé, je reste là. Quand soudain je me retourne, il se recule et la foule vient me jeter entre ses bras. Emportés par la foule qui nous entraîne, écrasés l'un contre l'autre, nous ne formons qu'un seul corps. Et le flot sans effort nous pousse enchaîner l'un et l'autre.
Estás escuchando a KBOO Portland en el 90.7 FM, K2H2BH Philomath en el 104.3 FM y K220HR Hood River en el 91.9.